Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I am Marina de Koning-Thijssen, neurologist and head of the Expertise Center of Movement Disorders in Groningen, the Netherlands. Today we are in the third episode of the Myoclonus special series and I'm here with Dr. Christos Ganos from the Toronto Western Hospital team in Canada. We will discuss the topic differential diagnosis of myoclonus. Christos comes from Greece, was trained at the University of Hamburg with Alexander Münchow and at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery at Queen Square with Kailash Bhatia. He worked as a consultant at the Charité in Berlin before he moved to the excellent Toronto Western Hospital team in Canada. In the MDS, he was the founding chair of both the MDS Tic Disorder and Tourette Syndrome Task Force and Study Group. His main topic is tic disorders, spanning from clinical characterization to studies on pathophysiology and novel treatment developments, inevitably connected with jerky hyperkinetic movements. One of his amazing and most downloaded paper is a video atlas of the spectrum of involuntary vocalizations in humans in movement disorders in 2019. Christos, thank you so much for joining me today. And I would say, let's get started.
Thank you, Marina, for the beautiful introduction. And it's nice to do this together.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to do it together. So to start with, Christos, what do you consider the most relevant differential diagnosis in myoclonus?
This is a very nice question, and it's actually a very nice opportunity to have to discuss this. So there are many ways to go about this, and we know that myoclonus is one of the big jerky hyperkinetic movement disorders. So you can think of the differential in general terms, but I don't think this is particularly helpful. It might be more helpful if we consider of the differential diagnosis based on somatotopy. And where do we see actually jerks or jerky movements occurring? And this will guide also our differentials and the difficulties we have in clinic in everyday life. Of course, when we speak about myoclonus, we have to consider and keep in the back of our minds epileptic disorders. So we're not going to deal with them. We are movement disorders, neurologists. But of course, when we see a jerky movements that fit in the myoclonus umbrella, and the myoclonus rubric, then we have to consider epilepsy. And we have to consider also syndromes like Jeevan syndrome and sunflower syndrome for eyelid myoclonia, etc. But if we go to proper movement disorder, so to say, one, and look by somatotopy, let's focus first on the neck region and cervical jerks. So the most common differential diagnosis we'll have there will be dystonic jerks. And we know that they also co-occur, like in myoclonus dystonic syndromes, for example, myoclonus dystonia. And we know that those myoclonic jerks are subcortical. So the distinction between a jerky dystonic movement and a myoclonic movement will be difficult and will be faced with this same question again and again, particularly, for example, in the onset of cervical dystonia, when people might have like subtle jerks of the neck before it starts to develop more and more in some cases. And also in full-blown syndromes, so we have jerky movements there. So when we think of the neck, I think the most clear question would be, is it myoclonus or is it dystonia? Now we can move upwards, for example, and go to the face. And we have observed in literature the difficulties between myoclonic jerks of the face and their distinction from choroic jerks, for example. And we know the ADCY5 story, that the original family was classified as having chorea of the face too, and then it came out that neurophysiologically it fulfilled criteria for myoclonus. And we have many different such examples. I think one I would like to highlight is the subtle smile that we ask our patients sometimes to do to unmask myoclonic jerks on the face, around the cheeks, and this can also look like tremulousness as well. So tremor and myoclonus will be also another differential we will have for the facial muscles, for the tongue muscles. So it is like a difficult differential in these cases. And we'll speak about clues later on. Another one, when we think about facial jerks, of course, we have to think of tics. But tics are usually easier to distinguish because of their suppressibility and their arch. Now, moving down to the arms, I think when we look at jerks at the arms, again, we have to consider of chorea. But looking particularly at distal jerks, then we come back to the question of, could this be rapid myoclonic jerks, for example, that we would see at cortical myoclonic tremor syndromes? or is this actual tremor? And this is another differential that is difficult on clinical grounds. Sometimes it's really difficult. And looking at jerks that occur in occasions during action and particular intention, and if we think of the Lancet Adams paper, the syndrome of action and intention myoclonus in post-hypoxic cases, I think intention myoclonus is something that's often missed and misunderstood or mislabeled as ataxia. And this can co-occur, but this is also important to keep in mind. Now, we have two body parts that left, and excuse me for the long answer. The legs, myoclonus of the legs, it's often mistaken as functional symptoms, like people stand and they jerk and they can't keep on standing because they jerk. And these are often older people, and this can be mistaken as a phobic component, anxiety or weakness. But this can be myoclonus, so it shouldn't be missed. And of course, myoclonus of the legs on standing can be also mistaken for orthostatic tremor. And the final category is the trunk, this entity of proprio-spinal myoclonus that you worked a lot on. We know that the majority of these cases will have functional jerky movements that will not be myoclonus. And there is also where our phenomenology classifications a little bit fail us. We still don't know whether to label these jerks as functional myoclonus or functional jerky movements. But yes, I think a functional etiology would be relevant there. And finally, the hyperplexic syndromes are startling. I think startling is also something that is sometimes difficult to distinguish. Is it on clinical grounds? Is it a pathological startling reaction, or is it actually increased anxiety? And there are clues as variability help us, perhaps.
Thank you so much for this very extensive. I like this way of classifying it by area. And can I ask you a few things about this? Because you're mentioning this issue of myoclonic dystonia and dystonia with jerks. Do you think age of onset can help us there about what of these subcategories you're thinking of? Because chronic dystonia, it's usually like in puberty, right? That it starts, which is usually not the case with dystonic jerks in the neck. They usually come at a later age. Or do you disagree?
No, I agree with whether we are looking with myoclonic dystonia as epsilon sarcoglycan, for example. And thank you for highlighting this. However, when I'm faced in the clinic with somebody who's in their mid-40s and they have cervical jerks on top of cervical dystonia, then I sometimes wonder, and thinking away from the etiology of a genetic etiology, perhaps I was unclear before, then I wonder, are these really rapid jerks there? Are these dystonia or are these subcortical myoclonus? And then when we try to approach them with neurophysiology, we don't get a helpful answer because they might have 300 milliseconds latency. And then you're like, or 350 or 400. And then what is it? That latency duration. Tricky.
And another question I would like to pose to you is, you're mentioning in the proprio-spinal, and I discussed that with Mark Edward in the next episode. But won't you agree that in every area where you have jerks, you should consider that it could be functional jerks?
Absolutely. And we see them a lot. They're usually labeled in different terms. I see in my clinics a lot of cases with jerky movements that are functional, labeled as functional tics or tic-like disorder. They don't come as functional myoclonus, but yes, any kind of jerk, of course, can have a functional etiology. Absolutely.
Okay. You gave this lovely overview of clinical differentiation between different movement disorders. Do you use a lot of additional investigations in your clinic to discriminate between the different types of movement disorders?
I'm a bit spoiled because at Toronto Western, there is a lab of Dr. Chen, and what they do there is fantastic with a 5-page report. On the neurophysiology. Yes, really. So it's a lot, and it's really beautiful and helpful. So neurophysiology, I think, in this case is where we are not sure if it's a cortical tremor versus cortical myoclonic tremor versus a tremor syndrome, where we still debate, could it still be myoclonus or dystonia? Could it be a functional jerky movement disorder, or could it be myoclonus? Neurophysiology is very helpful. And there we have really surface myography that might help, but we also can look at cortical potentials, etc. I think neurophysiology is the key examination here when we are clinically uncertain. One caveat there, though, it really is in the hands of the neurophysiologist who performs the examination and then the recording to provide you with useful results. If the neurophysiologist is also uncertain about or cannot tease out the characteristics that you want to be teased out and studied, then unfortunately also the neurophysiology investigation will not be helpful. So we have to keep this in mind.
Yeah. At the end, the clinical picture is the main one, right? It's supported by electrophysiology. But as you said, you're spoiled, so you get the whole package. But many people are not so spoiled, so they have to make choices. What would be your main investigation? And it can be different for different differential diagnoses, but what would be your main test that you would like to perform if you're doubting?
Yes. So let's stay a little bit on the clinical examination, because I think this is very helpful. And one thing I do is just putting, I'm asking the patient for permission, of course, and then putting my hands on the affected area and just using essentially my hands as the myography. Try to feel the jerks. And this sometimes tells you a lot. This can be enough, actually. And when you have this touch with your patient, you can also see, for example, if specific postures modulate the jerks, if distractibility, you know, we are also reliant on our visual perception, but if I'm doing a task with a patient on one hand and I'm holding the other arm, for example, I can feel what's happening there. So I think this is very helpful already.
Can you tell us what you feel, for example, if there is cortical myoclonus or subcortical myoclonus? Can you tell what you feel then in that arm?
Yes, I don't think I can. It's not a superpower that I can distinguish between cortical and subcortical myoclonus.
No, but just give us a sense. Yeah. Like,
essentially, you can, first of all, you feel the presence or absence of any jerkiness. You feel the rapidity of any kind of muscle twitch that will occur. You can feel if this is really a regular twitch occurring. So if you're going close to tremorlessness, or if there is co-contraction, for example, if the entire arm is stiff, you can feel these things very well. And you particularly on tests, contralateral arm or other body parts, ballistic movements, you can see if there is a pause, or you can feel if there is a pause of activity in the body part you're touching. So essentially, you're looking at silence of activity, etc., but in a very simple and crude way, but it's very helpful, essentially. I think people should start using it more. Clinical examination tools, for example, when people are uncertain if it's intention myoclonus, for example, versus ataxia, then you look at other movements. You look at the gait. And if it is intention myoclonus, you will have these big myoclonic jerks at the end of the movement. If it is ataxia, then, and it's so severe that it would lead to this jerkiness at the end of the movement as part of intention tremor or ataxia, then you would see it also at gait. So you're searching for discrepancies. So essentially, and you can look at proximal muscles too. In intention myoclonus, you will have the pectoralis also jerking. In ataxia, I don't think you will see this jerkiness there. So if it's a distinction of tics, of course, clinically, you ask for suppression. If it's chorea, you look for the flowing character. And if you're not sure about it, just keep observing. You don't have to make up your mind in 1 minute. This is the beauty of clinical interaction and examination.
Is that something that you teach to your residents and fellows? Take your time to look carefully, because that tells you a lot?
First of all, I learned it from you, from Kailash, now learning from Tony, from Susan. Like many people, you can learn from them and then pass it on exactly. So really take time and observe. And if you don't understand what you're, if you're confused, then see it a second time. This is really important. Like, we all make mistakes and we will keep on making mistakes. It's part of being human. And it's also nice because we can learn from them, as long as we don't harm. Just one category, Marina, that I forgot perhaps is the eye movements. And because we don't apply the terminology, we don't speak of myoclonus in rapid eye movements, but I have observed and I keep observing a lot of errors in the diagnostic labeling of different eye movements, abnormal eye movements. So I think, although it doesn't fit the topic, it's a category that people should also focus a little bit of efforts in distinguishing what is opsoclonus, what is flutter, etc. So I think it's just important so people keep the eye movements also in the rich neurological vocabulary in movement disorders. They're often neglected.
And do they help you in differentiating between types of movement disorders?
Absolutely, absolutely. Of course, we always look for gaze restriction, etc., in conjugate gaze, but of course, we're looking for cerebellar signs, we're looking for saccadic intrusions, we're looking for many different signs, we look for vestibulocular reflex. Actually, I'm surprised most people on a day-to-day basis don't examine the vestibulocular reflex. So I have always to ask, as a principal, how is the vestibulocular reflex?
Can I ask you another question? Because you mentioned about this difficulty between ataxia and myoclonus. Can you tell us a bit about negative myoclonus? How can that interfere with difficulties in your differential diagnosis? Because I've noticed that usually that people are not so much aware of that, but can be really a big problem for patients in daily life.
This is a great point back to being in touch with your patient. So really, if it's about myoclonus and standing, you just put your hand on the patient's leg with permission, and then you feel the lapse. You feel it. You don't need a myography. You just feel it. And the same with the arm. So I think negative myoclonus is a very helpful clue. And then there is a debate, and perhaps you can help us in the examination of a cortical myoclonus, essentially, and when we look for negative myoclonus. So there is a big issue with investigating cortical myoclonus in general. Let me just deviate a little bit, whether we do it completely at rest or on activation during posture. So where would you touch the fingertips, when the hand is resting or where it's active? I think there is a big debate. What would you say, Marika?
I'm in favor of holding the hand and let the hand drop at rest. So I'm holding the hand and then the hand's hanging down. And then I tip the fingers so they are at rest. But it's really helpful for me to see these delayed jerky movements once you touch the finger. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not for negative myoclonus, because for negative myoclonus, you have to stretch out and hold the hand palm straight and then see if there are lapses there, right?
You need the activation. Exactly.
Yeah. Do you agree, or I'm happy to hear that you disagree, that you should do it in action.
I agree, and Dr. Lang agrees that it should be at rest. Of course, with a negative myoclonus, there should be activation. I always wondered whether also for the positive myoclonus in cortical myoclonus, having a pre-activated state essentially facilitates its presence. And I don't know if this has been studied. So I just wonder.
Okay. Putting it together, Christos, I understand from you that you mainly base your differential diagnosis on the clinical picture and then different differential diagnosis based on where the myoclonus is, and that you, in general, would advise to do it mainly on clinical grounds. But if you're doubting, that then electrophysiology might help.
Yes, absolutely. Particularly in the tremulous case, you summarized it very well. And perhaps in the excitement of speaking with you and about this topic, of course, we're looking always for, after we made up our mind, what is the, is this myoclonus or is this chorea or whatever it is, but let's stick with myoclonus, then we already have this fast track association that myoclonus has. So myoclonus ataxia syndromes, myoclonus dystonia syndromes. We think of myoclonus plus syndromes. Mm-hmm. And then we try to piece this together to see, is this going that direction? Is this going that direction? Is there deafness, other signs? So to try to come slowly with a more definite diagnostic spectrum or range. Yeah,
I agree. That's very fascinating, isn't it? That the cortical myoclonus comes with ataxia and the subcortical comes with dystonia. That can really guide you also in the differential diagnosis. Yeah. Just one final answer, because you're saying it's all mainly on clinical grounds. And I fully agree with you. And as you said, that you can find support in electrophysiology. Do you think there is additional help here that we could have from machine learning in a way that we use videos for machine learning, or we use EMG or accelerometry? Do you think that will help the clinicians at the end? Do you have an idea about that?
Definitely, I think the more accurate we capture data, the more we will be able to also tease out subcategories of myoclonus syndromes that our eyes and our crude measures now fail to see, also patterns that we're not able to recognize. I really believe that we'll start to understand specific networks that relate to specific somatotopic symptoms and types of symptoms, duration of myoclonus, etc. So I think any kind of large data approach, even this is from a single person that will generate single case, that will generate large data, will advance our understanding. There is this caveat there, more power, more resistance, more data, more errors. So we have to also be mindful of that. But I think it will be useful, and it will also advance our understanding in ways that we have not been able to do in the last decades, for example. Mm-hmm. Yes, and you're working actively on that.
Yeah, so you don't dare to say it's not useful, right?
I would if I believe so, but it is definitely useful. It will become useful.
Yeah, I think you make a very important point there. similar to databases, rubbish in is rubbish out, right? So I think it's very important that if you do that, that you start with the gold standard of clinical examination, right? What does this patient have that I put in with a certain label? So I think that's a lot of work to do there. But it might in the future, like you said, help us to get more insight. And it might also help for less experienced neurologists as we're heading towards a period with perhaps less neurologists than what we hope we will have, that they might be able to already discriminate between certain movement disorders and that they not all have to come to an expertise center.
The beautiful part, Marina, now that I think about it, it will provide us dynamic measures. So let's imagine a single case that has hypoxic myoclonus, and then let's imagine a continuous EEG and EMG monitoring over days or months that would not be really bothersome for the patient to have on their bodies. And then it will provide us with data that we can see actually the evolution of cortical dynamics next to muscle activity, essentially. And this might help us understand what's exactly happening there in ways that we were not able before.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Christos. I think we had a lovely conversation on the differential diagnosis of myoclonus. And thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me in this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Marina, and the Movement Disorder Society. Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.